A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You step out onto your balcony in Tel Aviv, coffee in hand, ready to water the geraniums. The neighbor one floor down lights a cigarette. You retreat inside, slide the door shut. But the smell follows you. It's in the couch. It's in the curtains. It's been there since the previous tenant and the one before that. Here's what Daniel sent us. He's asking about third-hand smoke. How long can tobacco residues stay chemically active on surfaces at levels that actually cause harm? Is ripping out all the upholstery really the only fix? Or are there neutralization methods that work for a normal person's budget? And if you're walking through a rental right now, how do you assess whether there's been significant smoke exposure when all you've got is a vague sense that something smells off, or maybe an overwhelming air freshener that's working way too hard?
That last detail is the tell, the air freshener that hits you like a wall. I've walked into apartments where the scent was so aggressive my eyes watered, and the agent said the previous tenant was very clean. No, the previous tenant was very smoky, and someone spent the morning spraying eucalyptus mist on every porous surface in the unit. I actually toured one place in Florentin where they'd placed those gel bead air fresheners inside the air conditioning vents. The whole apartment smelled like a synthetic lavender farm. I pulled off a light switch plate, yellow-brown film underneath. The agent's face just dropped.
Covering the covers. It's like putting a silk scarf over a grease stain and hoping no one sits on the couch.
So let's define this properly, because the terminology matters. Third-hand smoke, THS, is residual nicotine and other combustion byproducts that absorb onto indoor surfaces, then either re-emit into the air as gases or react with ambient oxidants to form entirely new compounds. It is not the same thing as secondhand smoke. Secondhand smoke is what you inhale directly from the air while someone is smoking nearby. It's transient. It clears within hours. THS persists for months to years. It's not inhaled as visible smoke. It off-gasses from walls and fabric, or it transfers through skin contact and dust ingestion. If you have a toddler crawling on a carpet in a former smoker's apartment, that child is getting dosed through dermal absorption and hand-to-mouth behavior.
It's the difference between standing next to a campfire and wearing the jacket you wore to the campfire 3 months later, except the jacket is your living room.
That's the image. And the landmark paper on this, the one that really put THS on the map, came out of Lawrence Berkeley National Lab in 2010. Slyman and his colleagues showed that nicotine adsorbed onto indoor surfaces reacts with nitrous acid, which is just a common indoor air pollutant from gas stoves, car exhaust that drifts in, even some cleaning products. That reaction forms tobacco-specific nitrosamines, TSNAs, specifically NNK and NNN, which are known carcinogens. This isn't a theoretical risk. The chemistry happens at ambient indoor temperatures, and it keeps happening as long as the nicotine is there.
The cigarette goes out, the smoke clears, and then your walls start cooking up carcinogens from the residue, like a slow chemical factory you didn't sign the lease for.
Here's the part most coverage misses. The nicotine isn't just sitting there inert. It has a boiling point of 247 degrees Celsius, but it vaporizes slowly even at room temperature. It adsorbs to porous materials, drywall, carpet, upholstery, through hydrogen bonding and van der Waals forces. Once it's in, it's stubborn. Ball and colleagues published a study in 2014 showing that THS residues persist in a smoker's home for at least 6 months after the occupant quits, even after routine cleaning. And then Matt and colleagues in 2020 went further. They found THS markers in dust samples from non-smoking homes that had been smoke-free for over 2 years.
That's longer than most rental leases. That's longer than some marriages I've witnessed.
Longer than the warranty on the air purifier people buy thinking it'll fix the problem. Which it won't. HEPA filters capture airborne particles. They do nothing for the nicotine already embedded in the drywall. It's like trying to fix a leaky roof by mopping the floor. You're addressing the symptom in the air while the source is still up there, slowly dripping.
Let's talk about that. What actually happens inside the wall? You mentioned adsorption. Walk me through why nicotine is such a sticky little molecule. I want to understand why it doesn't just drift away like the smoke itself does.
Think of it like a Velcro strip on every porous surface. Nicotine is a nitrogen-containing base, an alkaloid. It forms hydrogen bonds with materials that have oxygen or nitrogen atoms available, which is basically everything in a home. Cellulose in drywall paper, wool and cotton fibers, polyester weaves. And on top of the hydrogen bonding, you've got van der Waals forces. Weaker individually, but across a large surface area like a carpet, they add up. The nicotine molecules tuck themselves into microscopic crevices. Once they're in, they're not coming out without chemical or mechanical intervention. Imagine trying to pull a single staple out of a shag carpet with your fingernails, then multiply that by a few trillion staples. That's what you're up against.
That's before the chemistry gets creative.
So you've got nicotine on your walls. Now introduce ozone. Ozone comes in from outdoor air, especially in cities, or from office equipment like laser printers. Ozone reacts with nicotine, oxidizing it and producing a range of secondary compounds, some of which are more volatile and more irritating than nicotine itself. Meanwhile, nitrous acid from your gas stove or from vehicle exhaust that seeps in through window seals reacts with nicotine to form those TSNAs I mentioned. The Sliman paper quantified this. They measured NNK formation at levels that, if you extrapolate to chronic exposure, fall into the concerning range for cancer risk. We're not talking about acute poisoning. We're talking about cumulative, low-level exposure over years. It's the kind of risk that doesn't announce itself with a cough or a headache. It just accumulates.
The sink effect. That's when the room decides to exhale.
That's the term, yes? Surfaces act as reservoirs. When temperature or humidity rises, a hot summer day, you turn off the air conditioning while you're at work. Those volatile compounds get released back into the air. Researchers call it a burp of THS. You come home, the apartment smells stale, and you can't figure out why because nobody smoked in there for a year. The walls are off-gassing, and it's not a one-time event, it's cyclical. Every temperature swing, every humidity spike, the reservoir breathes.
A Tel Aviv August. No AC running. Apartment sealed up. That's basically a third-hand smoke sauna. You're marinating in it.
Maximize re-emission conditions. And this isn't hypothetical. A 2019 study of 90 non-smoking homes in San Diego found THS markers in 100% of dust samples. 100%. The levels correlated with proximity to shared walls with smokers. If you live in an apartment building and your neighbor smokes indoors, it's coming through the walls. Not just the smell, the actual chemical residue migrates. It travels through electrical outlets, through gaps around pipes, through the microscopic porosity of the drywall itself.
Which means you could be a lifelong non-smoker, meticulous about your own space, and still have measurable carcinogen levels in your dust because the guy in 4B likes a post-dinner cigarette. You're an innocent bystander to someone else's chemistry experiment.
That's the enforcement gap. Secondhand smoke regulations focus on shared air in public spaces. THS is the private, persistent, unregulated residue that crosses property lines through drywall. Nobody's writing citations for nicotine migration through wall cavities. The regulatory framework hasn't caught up to the physics.
Of course they're not. The enforcement mechanism would be what? A chemical sniff test at the property line. We can't even get landlords to fix leaking roofs. The idea of a municipal THS inspector with a mass spectrometer is science fiction.
Which brings us to the practical question. You're standing in a rental. The agent is telling you it's been freshly painted. There's a plug-in air freshener in every outlet. How do you actually assess whether there's been significant smoke exposure?
The sniff test is useless, I assume. Your nose is a lying traitor in this scenario.
Worse than useless. It's actively misleading. Humans undergo olfactory adaptation. We stop smelling persistent odors after a few minutes of exposure. That's why smokers genuinely cannot tell their homes smell like an ashtray. Their noses have tuned it out. And if the landlord aired the place out for a week before showing it, the volatile fraction of THS might be temporarily depleted, but the reservoir is still in the walls. You walk in, it smells fine, you sign a 2-year lease, and then the first heat wave hits and your apartment smells like a casino. I've heard this exact story from at least 3 different renters. The pattern is always the same, viewed in winter, moved in during summer, discovered the truth in August.
What's the move? You can't exactly ask the landlord to core sample the drywall. Do you mind if I drill a few exploratory holes in the living room?
Three methods rank from cheapest to most technical. 1. The isopropyl alcohol wipe test. Take a clean white cloth, dampen it with isopropyl alcohol, and wipe a section of wall or windowsill. Not the freshly painted patch. Find a spot that might have been missed, like behind the refrigerator or inside a closet. If the cloth comes back yellow or brown, that's nicotine tar. This is the same method insurance adjusters use to assess smoke damage after house fires. It costs you about 3 shekels in supplies. And I want to emphasize, use white cloth. A colored rag will hide the evidence you're looking for.
If it comes back clean, but your spidey sense is still tingling, you know that feeling where everything looks fine, but something's off?
Method 2. Check the plastic. Nicotine stains plastic in a way that's hard to cover up. Light switch plates, outlet covers, window frames, the underside of blinds. If those have a yellowish-brown film that isn't just age and isn't just dirt, that's a telltale. Painters rarely bother to replace outlet covers. It's one of those corners that always gets cut because nobody looks there. And method 3, a handheld VOC meter. The consumer-grade ones, like the Air Gradient 01 or a PPBRA if you can borrow one, measure total volatile organic compounds in parts per billion. A clean home with no significant indoor pollution sources will baseline under 100 parts per billion. A THS contaminated home can read 500 plus. But I'll be honest, the VOC meter is a blunt instrument. It picks up paint, off-gassing, cleaning products, new furniture. You need to interpret the number in context. If the apartment was painted 3 days ago, a high reading might just be paint. If it was painted 6 months ago and the reading is still elevated, that's more suspicious.
The alcohol wipe is the star of the show. It's the one that doesn't require calibration or interpretation.
It's the cheapest, fastest, hardest to fake test you can do. Do it on every rental viewing. If the agent looks nervous while you're wiping the wall behind the couch, that's its own data point. I've had agents tell me you don't need to do that, which is exactly when you definitely need to do that.
All right, so you did the test. The cloth came back the color of weak tea, and you still took the apartment because the location was perfect and the rent was suspiciously low. You're in. The lease is signed. The keys are in your hand.
Now we talk remediation. And I want to be honest about what works and what's a waste of money, because there's a whole industry of smoke remediation products that make big promises. Walk into any hardware store and you'll find a shelf of miracles in a bottle.
Let me guess, ozone generators. They're always the first thing that comes up in any online forum. Someone says, smoke smell, and three people reply, buy an ozone machine.
Let's start there, because it's the most common misconception. Consumer ozone generators are marketed as smoke odor removers. The idea is that ozone oxidizes the odor-causing compounds. And it does, chemically speaking. Ozone reacts with nicotine and other volatile organics. The problem is what it produces in the process. That reaction generates formaldehyde, ultrafine particles, and other secondary pollutants that are themselves respiratory irritants and carcinogens. The EPI explicitly warns against using ozone generators in occupied spaces. Even in unoccupied spaces, the ozone dissipates, but the reaction byproducts don't. You're trading one indoor air problem for another. It's like putting out a kitchen fire with gasoline. Technically, the fire's out, but now you have a much bigger problem.
The thing with ozone, in the product name that Amazon recommends when you search smoke smell removal, snake oil. Or worse than snake oil, actively harmful snake oil.
At the consumer level, yes. Professional ozone treatment is a different category. Higher concentrations, sealed environments, followed by extensive ventilation. But even that only achieves about a 40 to 60% reduction in surface nicotine, according to a 2018 study by Destylitz and colleagues. It doesn't penetrate deep into porous materials. It's a surface treatment, and you're paying a professional to come in with industrial equipment, vacate the premises for 24 hours, and still only get halfway there.
What about washing the walls? Vinegar, baking soda, trisodium phosphate. The stuff your grandmother would have used. The old school solutions.
Trisodium phosphate, TSP, is effective at removing surface nicotine residue. It's a strong alkaline cleaner that breaks down the tar layer. Washing walls with TSP before painting is standard practice in smoke damage remediation. Vinegar and baking soda are milder and less reliable, but they'll remove some of the surface film. The limitation is the same. You're cleaning the surface, not what's embedded in the drywall itself. If the smoking was heavy and prolonged, the nicotine has migrated deeper than you can scrub. You're washing the skin of the wall while the muscle and bone are still saturated.
You clean the walls, you paint over them, and you've just entombed the problem. You've built a mausoleum for the nicotine.
Unless you use the right primer. This is where shellac-based primer comes in. Specifically, products like Zinserbin shellac is a natural resin that forms a vapor barrier. When you paint shellac-based primer over contaminated drywall, you're encapsulating the residues. They can't off-gas through the shellac layer. It's not removing the nicotine, it's sealing it in. But for a renter, that's often the practical goal. You're not trying to restore the apartment to laboratory purity. You're trying to stop the chemicals from getting into your air and your lungs. Think of it like wrapping asbestos pipe insulation rather than removing it. Containment is a legitimate strategy when removal isn't feasible.
What are we actually talking about in shekels?
About $50 per room for the primer, plus labor if you're not painting it yourself. It's the most cost-effective option short of full drywall replacement. Full replacement. Ripping out the drywall, the carpet, the upholstery. That's the only guaranteed solution, and it runs $5,000 to $15,000 for a typical apartment. That's not a renter's option. That's a landlord's capital expense, and good luck getting them to do it. I've never heard of a landlord voluntarily replacing drywall because a previous tenant smoked.
Shellac primer is the 80-20 solution. 80% of the benefit for 20% of the cost. The Pareto principle applied to indoor pollution.
If you pair it with carpet replacement, if the unit has carpet, you've addressed the two biggest reservoirs. Carpet is a nightmare for THS. The fibers have enormous surface area. The backing is usually porous, and vacuuming doesn't pull nicotine out of the pile. Steam cleaning with an extraction vacuum helps. It removes some surface residues, but a 2021 study found that dry cleaning removed about 70% of nicotine from cotton fabrics, but only 30% from polyester. Most modern carpets are synthetic blends. You're not getting it all out. And here's a detail most people don't think about. The carpet pad underneath. That foam layer is like a sponge for volatile compounds. Even if you clean the carpet fibers, the pad underneath is still off-gassing.
What about upholstered furniture that came with the rental? The couch that's been there since the Ben-Gurion administration?
That's the toughest category. A couch that's been in a smoker's living room for 5 years is a chemical reservoir. Steam cleaning will reduce the surface load. But deeply embedded nicotine in the foam and the frame, you're not reaching that. The only reliable fix for heavily contaminated fabric furniture is replacement. If the landlord won't replace it and you can't afford to, you're looking at slipcovers and acceptance of some residual exposure. And I'd add, if you're buying slipcovers, wash them before first use and wash them regularly. They'll pick up whatever the couch is off-gassing, and you don't want those compounds just sitting in the fabric next to your skin.
Which brings us to the lease itself. You mentioned Israeli rental contracts earlier. What legal footing does a tenant actually have here?
Israeli rental law doesn't specifically address smoking history. The tenant protection law gives you some leverage if a unit is uninhabitable, and THS contamination could qualify if you have medical documentation, especially for asthma. But it's untested. Most disputes never reach a ruling because the cost of litigation exceeds the deposit, so the practical approach is to address it before signing. Ask the current tenant directly if you can, not the landlord, the tenant, because they have less incentive to lie. Ask if smoking occurred indoors. If the answer is vague, do the alcohol wipe test during the viewing. If the unit smells strongly of air freshener, that's a red flag. Consider it the olfactory equivalent of a fresh coat of paint on a car with rust underneath. Someone's trying to make a problem invisible instead of fixing it.
If you have asthma or a kid with asthma, you can request a clause. Put something in writing.
A smoke-free history clause. The landlord warns that the unit has been smoke-free for at least 12 months prior to the lease start date and agrees to a penalty of X shekels or lease termination without penalty if third-hand smoke contamination is detected after move-in. Most landlords will push back, but if you have a VOC meter reading or a stained alcohol wipe from the viewing, you have leverage. You're not asking for a favor. You're asking them to warrant something about the property they're renting. You're saying, I have evidence this unit has been smoked in. If you're confident it's been remediated, put that confidence in writing with consequences.
The penalty clause matters because without it, the warranty is just words. It's a pinky promise in a legal document.
A warranty without a remedy is a wish. The clause needs teeth. Even a modest penalty, say 1 month's rent, changes the landlord's calculus. Suddenly, they have an incentive to actually verify the smoking history instead of just saying, sure, whatever. Without the penalty, they can warrant anything and face no consequences when it turns out to be false.
All right, let's cut through the noise and land on what actually works. If someone listening right now is in a THS-contaminated rental and can't move, what's the priority list? Give me the triage.
Priority 1, shellac-based primer on every wall and ceiling. That encapsulates the largest surface area reservoir. Priority 2, if there's carpet and you can negotiate with the landlord, replace it. If you can't, steam clean it with an extraction vacuum and run a HEPA air purifier afterward, not to fix the THS, but to capture any particulates stirred up by the cleaning. Priority 3, wash all hard surfaces with TSP or an equivalent alkaline cleaner. Windowsills, door frames, light fixtures, cabinets. Don't forget the tops of door frames and the blades of ceiling fans. Those are nicotine collection zones that people routinely miss. Priority 4, for upholstered furniture you can't replace, steam clean and use washable slip covers that you can launder regularly. And priority 5, ventilate aggressively. Not to remove the THS from surfaces, but to dilute the off-gas compounds in the air. Cross-ventilate for 15 minutes twice a day, even in summer. It's a management strategy, not a cure.
The stuff that doesn't make the list? The ozone generators, the ionizers, the scented candles, the bowls of vinegar left out overnight, the charcoal bags that Instagram keeps advertising.
Scented candles add more volatile organic compounds to the air. You're literally burning paraffin and fragrance oils in an already contaminated space. Bowls of vinegar absorb some odors but don't touch the nicotine on the walls. Ionizers produce ozone as a byproduct. Same problem as ozone generators at a smaller scale. Charcoal bags have some adsorption capacity, but they're passive and their surface area is tiny compared to the wall area of a room. These are cosmetic solutions to a chemical problem. They're air fresheners with better marketing.
The core message is, the smell is not the problem. The smell is the symptom. Treat the reservoir, not the odor. If you chase the smell, you'll be chasing it forever.
That's the shift in thinking that makes THS solvable. Most people approach it as an odor issue. How do I get rid of the smell? And they buy products that mask or temporarily neutralize airborne molecules. But the reservoir is still there, still reacting, still off-gassing. You have to think of it as chemical contamination, not a housekeeping issue. The same way you wouldn't air out a room with lead paint dust and call it fixed. You wouldn't spray Febreze on asbestos and declare victory.
There's a case study I came across that illustrates this. A renter in Tel Aviv, documented in an asthma forum, used a VOC meter to prove THS contamination in an apartment that had been presented as smoke-free. The reading came back well above 500 parts per billion. The landlord had painted and aired it out, so it smelled fine. But the meter doesn't care about smell. The renter presented the data. The landlord initially pushed back, and then the renter mentioned the alcohol wipe test results, yellow cloth, photographed, and suggested they'd be happy to involve the tenant protection authorities. The lease was terminated without penalty.
That's the power of measurement over impression. It smells fine is subjective. The VOC meter reads 520 parts per billion, and the alcohol wipe is the color of olive oil, is not. It shifts the conversation from, I don't like the smell, to, this unit has measurable chemical contamination. And that's a much harder argument for a landlord to dismiss.
Most landlords don't want that conversation on the record. They don't want a paper trail that says chemical contamination.
They really don't. Because once you document it, they can't claim ignorance if the next tenant has an asthma attack. And that's where the regulatory landscape might eventually shift. States, California, Maine, are already exploring THS disclosure requirements for rental agreements similar to lead paint disclosures. The logic is the same. It's an invisible, persistent hazard that disproportionately affects children and people with respiratory conditions, and tenants can't assess it through normal inspection. You can't see it, you can't smell it reliably, but the health consequences are real.
Is Israel anywhere near that conversation?
The Environmental Protection Ministry has focused on outdoor air quality, and honestly, they have their hands full with that. Indoor air quality regulation in Israel is fragmented. There are workplace standards, but residential rental disclosures for chemical residues? That's not on the legislative radar yet. The practical path for now is individual leverage. Test, document, negotiate. Be the squeaky wheel with a VOC meter.
Let me ask you something that's been in the back of my mind through all of this. We've been talking about tobacco. What about vaping? What about cannabis? Do the residues behave the same way, or are we dealing with a whole different beast?
That's the open question, and it's a big one. Early research suggests that propylene glycol and glycerol from vape aerosol also adsorb to surfaces. They're less studied than nicotine, but the mechanism is similar. Semi-volatile organic compounds that condense on surfaces and then re-emit. THC oils from cannabis smoking or vaping are even more complex chemically, and they're lipophilic. They bind to fatty residues on surfaces and in dust. The secondary chemistry, what happens when these compounds react with ozone or nitrous acid, is almost entirely unstudied. We know nicotine plus nitrous acid equals TSNAs. We don't know what THC distillate plus indoor oxidants equals. But the precautionary principle suggests it's not nothing. It's probably not producing something harmless.
The THS problem might actually be expanding even as cigarette smoking declines, because the replacement habits produce their own residues. We're not solving the problem, we're just changing its chemical signature.
Nobody's regulating it. The vaping industry positioned itself as the cleaner alternative to smoking, and for secondhand exposure that's partly true. There's no sidestream smoke from a vape device. But the surface residues? We don't have the data to say they're harmless. Absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. And given what we know about how sticky these semi-volatile compounds are, I'd be surprised if vape residue turned out to be benign.
Which means, in 10 years, we might be doing this same episode about vape residue, with a whole new vocabulary of compounds to worry about. Third-hand vape. THV. Someone's already trademarking that.
A whole new set of landlords claiming the previous tenant was very clean. The playbook doesn't change. The chemistry changes, but the real estate tactics stay the same.
The air freshener industry will thrive either way. That's the one constant.
The glockenspiel of corporate approachability.
Alright, let's wrap this into something someone can walk away with. You're viewing a rental. You've got a small bottle of isopropyl alcohol and a white cloth in your bag. What's the 30-second version? The elevator pitch for chemical self-defense.
Find an outlet cover or a closet wall that hasn't been recently painted. If the cloth is yellow or brown, nicotine is present. If it's clean but the apartment smells like a florist exploded, still be suspicious. Check behind the refrigerator, inside cabinets, under the sink. If you have access to a VOC meter, take a reading. Under 100 parts per billion is normal. Over 300, something is off-gassing. Over 500, you're in documented contamination territory. And take photos of everything. The cloth, the meter reading, the outlet covers. Documentation is your leverage.
If you're already stuck in a lease, you've signed, you've moved in, and now you know?
Replace carpet if you can. Steam clean everything else. And document your efforts. If you end up in a dispute, showing that you tried reasonable remediation strengthens your position. The law rewards the reasonable tenant. The tenant who just complains and does nothing has less standing than the one who can show receipts for primer and steam cleaning.
You can't always see it. You can't always smell it. But the chemistry doesn't lie. Know what's on your walls. Because your walls are not just walls. They're a chemical reservoir, and they're breathing right along with you.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In ancient Aztec Patoli, a board game played for high stakes, players used 5 black beans marked with dots as dice. And scoring combinations were so complex that Spanish conquistadors reported seeing players stake entire households on a single throw. Meanwhile, in what is now Somaliland, the same era's cave paintings at Las Gil depict cattle with decorated horns being herded by figures who appeared to be singing to them, suggesting a relationship with livestock that was closer to interspecies collaboration than mere domestication.
Right. I'm going to need you to explain the connection between Mesoamerican gambling and Somali cattle singing, but not today. Here's the thing I keep coming back to. We regulate what we can see. Smoke in the air, you can point to it. Ash on the ground, you can fine for it. But the residue in the drywall, the nicotine that's been there since before you moved in, the chemistry that keeps working long after the cigarette is cold, that's invisible. And invisibility is the best friend of neglect, so test it. The alcohol wipe costs less than the coffee you were holding when you stepped onto that balcony. It's the cheapest insurance policy you'll ever buy.
If this episode saved one person from signing a 2-year lease on a chemically contaminated apartment, it was worth the research. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumentop, for keeping this show running.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
If this was useful, leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.